Hello and welcome to another Linguistics CareerCast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton.
Kelsey Krause is a computational linguist, data scientist, and educator. She received her PhD in linguistics from the University of California, Santa Cruz in 2018, where she worked on the semantics and pragmatics of intonation and discourse particles in English and German. She joined the linguistic faculty at San Jose State University in 2026 after working several years in Silicon Valley as a linguist and senior data scientist at Google, Amazon, and Cisco. Kelsey was a featured speaker at the Linguistics Career Launch 2022, where she presented a session on human language technology industry jobs. Topics discussed today include syntax, informational interviews, LinkedIn, voice UI, LLMs, chat agents, computational linguistics, corpus linguistics, and return to academia. Links to Kelsey's LinkedIn and other resources are in the show notes. If you'd like to support this show, we've got a Patreon. One of our patrons is the fabulous Lingthusiasm podcast, hosted by Gretchen McCullough and Lauren Gaughan. That's about linguistics as a way of understanding the world around us. If you're not listening yet, you really should be. And if you think you'd be a good guest on the show, or you'd like to recommend a linguist for me to interview, please fill out the contact form on the website at linguisticscareercast.com. I would love to welcome to the show Kelsey Krause, who's actually, this is your second time being on the podcast, although I didn't interview you for the first one. You were a wonderful guest at our LCL all the way back in 2022, which seems like a million years ago, right, at this point.
That's true. Yeah, it was all online, all during kind of the end of COVID era. But yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is great. So at that time, in the before times, you were working in industry and you were working at Cisco, and your talk then was about human language technology. And you were talking about your experiences and providing some advice and doing a little Q&A with people about how to get a job doing that specifically, because that was where you were working. And then since then, you have gone back into academia, which is super interesting. So today, you know, would love to talk about how you got involved in what you do, you know, getting your linguistics degree and working in human language technology, and then how you got out of it and went back into academia, because I don't think that's too unusual. There, you know, we've known a number of people through LCL who have done that very thing, but would love to know specifically for you, what prompted you to do that? So let us start, as we always do, by asking people, how did you know, or how did you find out that you wanted to get a degree in linguistics?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like a lot of people's answers are probably similar in that they were looking through the course catalog in undergrad and thought, oh, what's linguistics? That seems so cool. I was already German studies major at the time. So I was already interested in languages. I've kind of always been interested in language, to be honest. So yeah, it was a really natural, German studies. Oh, linguistics class. I would get to put off other, you know, other classes that I don't want to take by taking this elective. yeah, so that's kind of how I started, just randomly taking Ling 101 at some point.
Did you know what linguistics was before you took Ling 101?
I don't think I did, actually. No. I mean, I knew it was related to language. I knew it was about sounds of the language, because that's what you got from the course catalog. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, I was just always fascinated with language. I remember when I was in fourth grade during an after-school program, the Spanish class was full. And that was what I really wanted to take. And the class that wasn't full was a class that was called Lao Literacy Class. I didn't know at the time, and neither did my mom, that it was actually for heritage speakers of Lao. Uh-huh. You know, there was a large Hmong population in my town growing up. And so I was the only person in the class who was not a heritage speaker of the language. I think I lasted like 2 weeks in the class, because we started with writing, and it was super cool to, you know, write in this other language and in this other script. And then once it started getting into the speaking part, I was you know, pretty aware that I was not going to be able to keep up with my classmates
there. Yeah, you were definitely at a disadvantage there. But what a great way to be exposed to it. I mean, that it's a thing that people should have the opportunity to do, right? Like, just get plopped down into a class where you know nothing about the language and see right. what it's like. It's so right. cool to do that. Yeah. So as you took Ling 101, like, what was it about that really got you where you were like, oh, this is what I like?
Well, I think obviously I knew I liked languages, period. I knew that I liked English as well. I think it was really when we got to the syntax portion of the mm-hmm. intro class where, you know, you see how sentences can be diagrammed in a particular way. You can see this underlying structure. There's patterns there, and those patterns can be applied to so many different languages. And all you have mm-hmm. to do is just kind of change your rules a little bit. And it really like scratched that itch in my brain of like, oh, I can do this. You can just kind of think about languages and patterns and solving these types of problems for a degree. It seemed like something I wanted to do.
So you switched your major from German to linguistics?
I actually added linguistics as a major.
Okay.
So I double majored, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, typical overachiever, yeah. double major in linguistics. Many of us out there, I'm one of them. And then did you know that you wanted to go on to do a graduate degree after it, or were you going to take some time off after the bachelor's?
I actually didn't, no. So I had applied for the master's program at UC Santa Cruz, which is where I did my undergraduate degree mm-hmm. as well. And was accepted, but also wasn't sure, you know, the master's program is, you know, there's the financial component of it. I had also applied for the Fulbright English Teaching Assistantship Program and was accepted. And I was given the opportunity to go to Germany and teach English in Berlin for a year. So I actually put it off. I put the decision off for a year. And the department let me, which was very nice of them. And it wasn't really until I was in Germany, I was doing some of the English teaching, but then I also was hooked into the Humboldt University in Berlin and started taking some or auditing some graduate linguistics classes there, where I thought, you know, maybe I should go back. Maybe I should try this as something that to do, you know, as a graduate program. And then I reached back out to the UC Santa Cruz program, said, you know, is it still possible for me to apply to the, or to have that master spot? And they said, sure. Would you actually like to be in the PhD program instead? And I said, oh, sure. So that's kind of how that happened.
Oh, that's great. And were you committed to doing the whole PhD at that point, like going straight through?
Yeah. Yeah, I was.
That's awesome. And when you started the graduate program, did you have an idea of what your focus was going to be? Or was it just like, I'll discover it along the way?
Yeah, I think my focus was actually going to be German syntax. So
one of the
classes that I had taken in Berlin was this German syntax seminar on ellipsis processes in German. And I was so fascinated because, you know, a lot of the syntax, at least that I learned as an undergrad, was really English focused. Mm-hmm. And it was really the first time that I was able to see, you know, really how to do research in syntax in another language and kind of, you know, talk about the differences cross-linguistically. So I went in thinking I would do something like that. And then that's not at all what my dissertation ended up being. Again, probably something that a lot of people experience as well, going in thinking, oh, I'm going to just focus on this one thing. And then kind of getting sidetracked and figuring out that that's not actually what they wanted to do. At UC Santa Cruz, the way that you qualify to advance to candidacy is that you write two qualifying papers. And one of the qualifying papers has to be on your in your offside subject. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't do two qualifying papers on syntax. You can't do two on phonology. And so I had taken the first year sequence and was really interested in semantics and started working on this modal particle in German, doch. And it's like, oh, well, I'll just talk about the semantics of this particle. Actually, I started out thinking, oh, I'll talk about four different modal particles and I'll talk about how you can combine them, because German has this really interesting modal particle system that, you know, contributes this pragmatic information above and beyond what the sentence is actually contributing. And I was like, oh yeah, I'll do this modal particle combination thing and then I'll be able to move on and talk about German syntax. Well, it turned out that was actually my dissertation topic. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That I wrote this paper, I had to scale it way back because it turns out nobody's even in consensus as to what like the particles mean in and of themselves. So how can you actually know what they mean when they're combined, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I had to do this whole paper on this and then just was hooked. I had to know. I had to figure out all of these other, what these other particles meant, and then this kind of realize that it interacts with intonation. And so, oh, what's the pragmatic significance of intonation? What does it mean? How do these things combine? Do they combine? Is it additive? Is it multiplicative? And so that kind of, you know, sparked my whole dissertation research project as well.
That sounds so cool. And it sounds like such a typical linguistic experience. You know, you get interested in a topic and you think, well, I can just work on this thing. It's mm-hmm. not going to take me very long, right? How much could there be? And then the more, you know, the tinier the particle and the more you get into it, the more you find out, like, I could spend the rest of my life studying this, actually.
Yep.
But that's the beauty of it, right? That's the thing I love about linguistics is that there's always more. There's always more to learn. And you know, as they always say, the more you learn, the less you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So as you're going through it and you're writing this incredible dissertation, you're learning all this stuff, what were you thinking was going to be the end point for you after you got your degree? Like, did you have an idea of what you were going to do once you'd finished?
I didn't really start thinking about that until I had to, which mm-hmm. was probably the fall before I defended my dissertation. At that point, I was a little burnt out, to be honest.
Yeah.
And also the job market wasn't the best that year. There were a couple of full-time positions. There were a couple of postdocs, but none of them were in places that I wanted to be. You know, this is kind of the plight of the academic in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. If you're looking for an academic job, you don't get to pick where
yeah.
it is. And I was being a little bit stubborn about it. I didn't want to go to those places. I didn't want to only have a 1-year postdoc at a place and then have to find another thing the next year and then have to potentially uproot my life multiple times. You know, it just didn't sound appealing to me. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, you know, in the years leading up to me defending my dissertation, a lot of people from UC Santa Cruz's program went on to have pretty successful careers in tech. And I was friends with a lot of those people. They're giving me kind of the inside scoop on what's going on, what kind of projects they're working on, like where there might be openings. And so, you know, I kind of thought, oh, well, I'll just do this. I'll just go into tech. They seem to like it. Maybe I'll like it too. And yeah, there was, I think, one postdoc position that I applied for mm-hmm. kind of half-heartedly, kind of because my advisor told me I should do that. But yeah, in the end, I kind of just decided that I was going to take a break. I was going to go into tech and do that.
Yeah. And so I was just looking at your LinkedIn. So that's like 2018, right? As you're finishing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as I think everybody knows right now, the situation in academia has only gotten worse for people looking for something in academia once you finished your PhD for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. Too many people who are looking, but also funding for positions has just gone, you know, there isn't any funding really.
Right. That's true.
And so many, unfortunately, so many universities are shutting down a lot of their social sciences and humanities programs anyway, which is like insane.
It is. It is.
To think that they're just not going to have, you know, modern language programs or linguistics programs anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think the job market in academia is only going to get worse unless, I don't know, what's going to happen to make it better.
Right.
So all of that prep that you do as a graduate student, you know, we're sort of groomed, right? As you go through the program to be an academic, you're teaching and you're learning things and you are being shaped to pass this information along to the next generation
right.
of linguists, but then you don't really get that chance, unfortunately. And I don't know. I don't know where it's going to end. It's very sad. But I do think, and maybe you can talk about this a little bit, because I've certainly found it true in my work, you do get a chance to pass some of that along to non-linguists just in the kind of work that you do, because in most industry jobs, you do get to use your linguistics kind of every day and you show people what linguistics is. You're not teaching, you're not standing up in front of a classroom and leading people through instruction or, you know, units or giving them homework, but you are sharing your linguistic knowledge with people. And that's pretty satisfying most of the time.
It is. Yeah. I actually have told people, you know, in other forums, you know, I've done a couple of talks about, you know, how to take your skills as a linguist and kind of make them something that, you know, would get you a job interview or get you that position. And the way that I tend to think about it is like we as linguists in a lot of ways kind of act as a liaison between a bunch of different types of job roles wherever we are. So I, you know, we are a lot of times technical enough that either we're doing part of the engineering pipeline or we're working with people who are doing part of an engineering pipeline, but we're also talking with product managers or people doing data annotation or people who are much more sales oriented, right? So you can kind of bridge that gap between super engineering heavy and super kind of product heavy. And you're a lot of the times that go between, because one of the things that you learn being a linguist is like being able to take this really complex puzzle and pick it apart into its component parts and then talk about it and talk about it in varying levels of technical detail. So yeah, it's one of the things that, like you said, like I really enjoyed when I was in those more technical or roles in the tech industry, was being able to kind of, yeah, do that teaching to various groups who maybe don't have the, well, either the engineering expertise or the kind of larger picture, and then also bringing that like familiarity with language and patterns of language and yeah, linguistic data to both sides as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I have found it, and I'm sure you have too, just as linguists, we all really share that because, you know, we're all freaks about language. And it's like everybody should be as fascinated with language as we are because language is amazing and we all love it so much. Okay. So to get back to you, so once you made this decision that, you know, you were going to try to get into industry, what specifically were you doing then at that point to start looking around for jobs? You know, how did you do your networking and who were you talking to? I think people, I know you talked about some of this in your LCL talk, which people can find, by the way, if you go to the LCL YouTube channel, your talk is there. And it's also earlier in this podcast. If you go back near the beginning, we put the audio up if you just want to listen to the podcast, but it would be good if you could revisit that. That'd be great.
Sure. Yeah. So a lot of what I was doing was, well, so like I said, I kind of had this network of people from my graduate program, luckily, who were in industry, so they kind of had their feelers out. But of course, coming from an academic program and getting plopped down into a tech job it's non-trivial, right? It's very, very different. The day-to-day is very different. What you're actually doing is very different. And so what I actually did was did a bunch of informational interviews with people. So mm-hmm. I just reached out and said, hey, can you give me 15 minutes of your time and tell me what you do during the day? Like, you don't have to tell me trade secrets, but just what does your day look like? What should I be thinking about in terms of how to go about preparing myself for this type of role? And, you know, some of the things that I was told was, well, you need to know a little bit of Python. It's always good to have a little bit of coding experience, or at least be willing to learn how to mm-hmm. do that. You know, be flexible, be good at communicating, written communication as well as verbal communication. And then just knowing kind of how to decipher the technical skills necessary in the job listings that you're looking at. One of the things too, one of the most valuable pieces of information that someone told me when I was looking for jobs was, if you read a job review and you think 70% of this applies to me, you should apply for mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. That other 30%, whatever, you can learn it on the job.
Yeah, that's what we often call the wish list for jobs, yeah. right? Like, that's what employers are putting down. It's you have to think of the word requirement, not literally.
Right.
yeah. It's yeah. what they wish that you could have. And it's great if you have a lot of it, but you don't need to have all of it. Go and apply for it anyway.
Right.
So you did informational interviews, and did that lead to specific, like, were you applying to jobs, or were you getting interviews via people that you knew? You know, how did that work out in terms of you actually applying to places?
Yeah. So I ended up applying to a couple of positions. They were all contract positions, so they weren't through people that I knew. They were just, well, let me back up. They were through people that I knew, in that they told me that they knew that there were contract positions available mm-hmm. at Google, for example. But I just applied through whatever, I think it was LinkedIn, honestly, and got a couple of interviews and was offered a position on at the time, the speech team at Google. At the time, they were creating text-to-speech voices for the Google Assistant in a bunch of different languages, mm-hmm. Expanding into languages like Hindi and Indonesian. I think we did a couple of different varieties of Spanish. And yeah, I mean, I worked as a linguistic project manager there. I actually worked on a Hindi and English voice that would be able to code switch back and forth to you.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
You could speak in either English or Hindi, or you could speak in a mixture of both, and it would usually just speak back in one of the languages. It wouldn't switch back and forth to you, but it could tell that you were language switching.
That's so cool. That's yeah. really cool. What was it? Okay. I'm just thinking, you know, so you go in, you're an English speaker, but you also speak German mm-hmm. and maybe you speak other languages. I don't know. But what was it like working on something that's in Hindi, which presumably is a language that you don't speak? How was that? Like, what did it feel like going in to work on a language that you don't speak it, but of course you're a linguist, so you understand how it's constructed and how it differs from other languages. Like, what was that experience like?
Yeah, it was really fun, actually. One of the things that we were tasked to do was basically outline what the phonological inventories were for the languages that we were working on. And specifically, because I was working with English and with Hindi, I had to basically create two phonological inventories, one that would recognize English phonology and one that would recognize Hindi phonology. And so that was really cool to be able to kind of define the set there and define, you know, how you transcribe words in either of these languages, depending on which one shows up. One of the difficulties actually was that, of course, Hindi is not written in a Latin script, right? It's mm-hmm. written in Devanagari. And there were some issues with being able to Like how you would represent this on the screen. Would you write it all out in Latin letters? Would you write it all out in Devanagari script, right? Would you switch back and forth depending mm-hmm. on what the user was saying or what was being said back to the user? So those were some of the big questions and hurdles that you had to kind of get over was, you know, what is best for the user? Mm-hmm. And the good thing about this project was it wasn't just me working on it on my own. There were other people who I helped coordinate who were Hindi speakers, mm-hmm. who spoke English and Hindi. And so I was kind of the lead of a team who was doing the data annotation there. And so, you know, I would bring these questions to them and we would talk about, you know, what happens in these corner cases or in these non-corner cases, mm-hmm. in these very like everyday cases that are going to come up where you need to be able to have a representation of this language that's consistent, but that has these constraints in how they're actually being represented. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it was at the time, it was pretty intellectually interesting. Of course, that project ended pretty quickly. And, you know, you move on to other languages. But that one was one of the ones that I really look back on fondly working on. Because it did seem like an actual, this is a linguistics project. This is where linguistic expertise is necessary and warranted.
I was just going to say, listening to you talk about, it strikes me as this is, you know, we always say you need a linguist for that. Mm-hmm. And as you're describing it, that's the only thing I can think of is the kinds of perspective that you bring to this job is something that really only a linguist can have. There are engineers who might know better about the technical end of it, but to take all those things into consideration, what you're saying, you know, you're looking at the phonological sets and, you know, responses and things, but all the pragmatics that go into it and the social contexts and all of those things, you really need a linguist who has a well-rounded education in linguistics to right. combine it to say, this is how language works. It's never in a vacuum. It's spoken by human beings. Yep. And it's not just code. It's not just symbols. It's not just a phonological set. It all has to be integrated. And I think that's what people miss sometimes is that linguists are the people who have that kind of knowledge. And it's not just translation, right? Linguistics right. isn't translation. It's everything that you take together. And in those situations, in those kinds of jobs, you absolutely have to have linguists to get at all of those things. And then to take you as a linguist to speak with the native speakers to mm-hmm. bring their perspective in as well to make sure that you're actually doing it correctly.
Absolutely. And also when things go wrong, right? Mm-hmm. We had a bunch of issues where you know, they're creating these voices and then they synthesize the voice at the end, right? After all this data has been collected and annotated and the model's been trained and then the voice sounds bad. Mm-hmm. Like, well, why does the voice sound bad? There are, you know, there might be model technicalities that go into it. But one of the things that we found when we trained this English and Hindi code switching data set was that there were just under representations of some of the phoneme transitions from English words into the Hindi words. And so, you know, that's something that would be really hard to diagnose if you weren't kind of attuned to that already. If that wasn't how your brain worked, like looking at this type of data, you wouldn't think, oh, it's at the word boundary between the English word and the Hindi word.
Right.
That's where where this weirdness happens, right? And so, you know, again, that's where that expertise comes in and that kind of problem-solving mentality and attunedness to language really, really helped.
Yeah, completely. Oh, that's great. It's so cool to talk about the, you know, the level of detail in the job. And I think that's why linguists are needed in jobs like these, really, really needed to make it actually work. And I think, you know, companies have since then, I know it doesn't seem that long ago, but it is almost 10 years ago, 2018 to now, not 20, but 10 years ago, that that type of awareness amongst companies has really risen, that you do need language experts to make those kinds of judgment calls and to have the knowledge. It seems since that first LCL even that we did, the awareness level of linguists in that in industry, like that kind of industry, has risen quite a bit, which is awesome. You know, who knows about jobs, because right. the tech industry is like insane at the moment, but at least people do understand the value that linguists bring to jobs like that and don't just think, well, we can hand it off to some engineers and they can definitely do it. And I think we're even starting to see some pushback against the, you know, well, AI can just handle it, because obviously AI cannot handle it. And we're starting to see people go, oh yeah, actually it can. And it does a really terrible job. And maybe we need some actual humans who have knowledge to solve these problems.
Right.
So you were there and you had this contract work. So what was your path after that?
Right. So after my contract ended there, I got a position at Amazon. I was working on the Alexa at the time, Alexa Auto specifically. It was, I think, supposed to be a competitor to Google Maps. I don't know if it ever actually competed. But, you know, we were doing things like direction intent. So I went from doing a lot of speech and like phonology related work to actually doing more of the semantic understanding. So we were doing a lot of intent recognition, you know, making sure that the Alexa was able to distinguish, you know, take me from place X to place Y, from, you know, just asking a question about place X or place Y. Yeah, it was an interesting position. I didn't love it. To be honest, I was pretty quickly looking for something else after that. And that's when I found the job at Cisco. I was actually originally hired at Cisco to be a voice user interface designer. So I was hired on the design team, actually, to basically create conversational flows for a product that they were developing at the time. That product was unfortunately kind of killed by COVID. I was hired in April of 2020, and by July of 2020, it was quite clear that this product was no longer going to be shipped out and used. It was supposed to be obviously an in-person thing. We had to go do all this in-person testing that kept being pushed out, then finally canceled, and, you know, the project fizzled out. But I was able to switch from that team to another team that was doing a lot more machine learning, and they actually were the team that created the WebEx Assistant. So WebEx is a competitor to something like Zoom or Microsoft Teams. It's a meetings software. And the cool thing about the WebEx Assistant is that there are a bunch of Cisco video devices in conference rooms. And the thought behind it was, what if based on your device walking into a room, this assistant could recognize your device, recognize that it's you, and then greet you on the screen. And you could say things like, okay, WebEx, start my meeting. And your meeting would be started in that room. And it would be all verified by the fact that, you know, my obviously is a personal pronoun. It's not start Kelsey's meeting, right? It's start my meeting. And so you have to know who my is indexed to, right? And so if I walk in with my laptop, and the room device is able to verify that my laptop is the same user who has a meeting that's scheduled in that room, if I say, start my meeting, it will just seamlessly start. So it was kind of a cool technology, still is. I don't know how much it gets used now, but I was working on the team that created that. So again, it was similar to what I was doing at Amazon, kind of expanding the functionality of the types of requests that this assistant could handle. Things like scheduling meetings, obviously starting meetings, calling people, And then there were various other functionalities for that as well. But then, of course, you know, in, what was it, November 2022, ChatGPT, like, rocked the world or whatever. And my team transitioned into doing a lot of evaluations of outputs for large language models. The focus from the inside was, okay, we need to switch over a lot of our older machine learning models to these newer, you know, generative models, these much larger models. But one of the things that you have to do is extensively test them, especially because a lot of the output is language, right? It is just generated speech, generated language. And so what my job turned into was making sure that the output of these chat agents or the output of a meeting summary wasn't hallucinating or wasn't fabricating details, adding or not including information that it should be including. And what happened was, you know, this shift happened so quickly and everyone was doing it all at the same time that what ended up happening was that this type of work in a lot of cases was deprioritized, right? Mm-hmm. The rush to just have this new shiny thing meant that people were just deploying these models, these conversational agents without actually testing to see whether they were vulnerable or whether they actually worked or whether they actually did the thing that the user wanted it to do. And I do think that my team, you know, we were a little bit slower on the uptake, but it's in part because we had this moment of, no, we have to stop and make sure that what we're doing is not actually going to be harmful to the person using it. So that's kind of where I left off at Cisco before I transitioned to where I am now.
Yeah, I was also going to say harmful both to the people, but also to the company, that the whatever the output is isn't revealing like trade secrets or breaking confidentiality or, you know, because I've read about that as well, especially at large companies, keeping a lid on things that are secret in terms of contracts and revealing numbers and project plans and stuff is so important. And yet, AI and LLMs don't know that. And sometimes we'll just reveal these things and it's very disruptive. One of the other things I wanted to mention is that I think a lot of people are still unaware that within big companies, and Cisco's a really good example, you know, for many years, the Cisco conferencing system, telepresence, was this thing unto itself that was unlike anything else. Do they still use telepresence, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Like if you've ever seen it in real life, it is like in the movies where it's huge and it's like you're sitting in a room with people. And so many companies who are highly technical like that have their own internal systems and they need people to work on their own internal systems that you may never hear about otherwise because they're proprietary and they still need people to work on them to do the visual stuff or the voice processing stuff or the output stuff. So there's still projects that exist within companies that are not, you know, known outside of it, but they're still cool and fun to work on because companies need them. And I think Cisco always has some stuff that's always going on internally that most people just don't know about.
Yeah. That's true. And a lot of Cisco's products too are used in like government settings because they take security very, very seriously.
Yeah, definitely.
And so, you know, a lot of, and I think they might be more expensive as well, right?
They so, like, definitely are. Yeah.
Universities tend to use Zoom because they have a really nice education package. Cisco is saying, you know, we're gonna focus on providing WebEx meetings for, you know, secure exchange of information. Mm-hmm. For example, I remember while I was working there was this photo that came out of President Macron from France, and he was using a WebEx device. And everyone was like, oh my gosh, like such great publicity for WebEx Assistant. The French government is using our product.
Yep, totally. And the security concerns, of course, with the spoken and, you know, devices that listen is twice as high because, or more than that, because I used to, you know, Cisco was a client of mine back in the day, and there were already concerns about could people ever use their personal phones to make company calls because they were worried about, you know, speech being recorded and then what would happen to it and what if people were listening in and how do we make it secure? And, you know, if you needed to record a call, could you ever do that on your personal phone? I know that's still a concern going on. So there's a lot of concerns around speech processing, speech generation, and now things like transcripts as well, right? Like whatever the software is that's producing a transcript, where does that live and who gets to look at it? And security concerns for that are just wild because there are so many different apps now that can produce transcripts. It's like, well, if it's being done on a server that's living in who knows where, like who has access to that? You have to know. Right. You can't just assume that it's going to be secure because the company says it's secure. Like you can't believe that.
Right. I will say Cisco really is secure. I never ever saw a meeting transcript or a meeting recording from an actual meeting that wasn't an internal meeting. And it's kind of to the frustration of the people who are working on the product because you want to have at least some of that data to make sure that what you're building is suiting the needs of the people. But on the other hand, Cisco says, absolutely not. We think that privacy is much more important than you having data to build your little software project. And, you know, yes, it's a large corporation. There are things that, you know, they can be admonished for, but that one is not one of them. Yeah, no, they take security seriously.
Yeah, totally agree. And that's partly why it costs so much more, you know, and it's for a lot of people, it's definitely worth it. Okay. Yeah. So enough about Cisco, you know, I mean, Cisco still hires a lot of people. And I think they have a fair number of linguists who work there still. But how did you part ways with Cisco? What happened?
Yeah, so at the time, I had been working in tech for about 7 years at that point, obviously in a bunch of different kinds of roles. I have been lucky in that all of my roles really are or have been related to linguistics and language processing and understanding. But, you know, the thing that was really kind of getting to me was the fact that in a lot of cases, you're really lacking a human-centered perspective on these language technologies. Mm-hmm. A lot is being pushed by engineering. A lot is being pushed from the top down by people who are distracted by these flashy models, right? These flashy things that can maybe do really cool things, but also maybe not. And, you know, it was in this point where AI technologies are exploding. They're becoming super accessible. Everybody's using them, but it was really the kind of lack of rigor and foresight and general knowledge about how to use and develop this technology in safe and ethical ways that was really distressing to me working on these technologies. And, you know, it just kind of became this thing that I really didn't want to participate in anymore. And, you know, kind of backing up, I've kept myself kind of on the outskirts of academia since I graduated. So I taught classes a couple times at UC Santa Cruz, partially because I really do like teaching. And also partially because, you know, it was something that, you know, I didn't explore. It was something that maybe I would have wanted at another point in my life. And also, like, teaching gave me this realization that kind of having that link between what you're doing in the university setting and how that knowledge that you're gaining could be applied to your professional life outside of college or outside of grad school, like that's something that I didn't have when I was in college, right? Yeah. Like you were saying, like we were saying before, you're prepared in a very specific way when you go through a grad program, right? You're prepared to go into academia and continue the research and continue teaching. You're not necessarily prepared to have those alternate pathways, right? Like going into tech. And as I started kind of thinking about it, I was also realizing this trend that, you know, a lot of the people that I worked with in industry, either in the machine learning side of things or engineering, right, they're really, really good technologists, but they don't have any of that underlying kind of linguistic knowledge. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are really now just starting to realize the impact of what's being created with these, what are essentially linguistic technologies, right? Mm-hmm. These large language models, right? Just in terms of like the data that's used or the energy that's used and the implicit assumptions and biases that infiltrate your data if you don't have good data that train your models, or how implicit ideas can be baked into a model because of the type of data that does or doesn't go into training it, right? And like, to us, it's obvious, like the language that you use, the structures, who's talking about these things, those are all going to be things that are learned and regurgitated by these models. But these are things that you tend to have to explain over and over and over again to people who are just building the models.
Totally.
And, you know, I had kind of been trolling some of the academic job postings for a while, just kind of thinking, you know, I've been out of academia in terms of the type of research that I used to do, but I've been doing a lot of research in things like computational linguistics. That's basically what my job has been for the past 7-ish years. And then this position at San Jose State came up where they were looking for a computational linguist. And specifically in their job posting, they were looking for someone who was willing to help expand their new computational linguistics undergraduate degree and master's program.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. And so I thought this is a really cool program that they're doing. It's this program that is housed both in the linguistics department and the computer science department. So it's a lot of students who I think traditionally would be just pure computer science majors, but they've decided to add on that linguistic aspect of things. Mm-hmm. And these are people who are going to, well, you know, the hope is that they will go and work in Silicon Valley. They will work in these tech companies doing language-related technologies. And, you know, as someone who had spent the last 7 years doing language-related technologies and being one of these people who kept having to kind of reteach and, you know, give this message of spread the linguistics gospel, if you will. You know, I thought, why not go to the source? What if we could actually have this program where, you know, expand the program such that you have this linguistic knowledge as well as the engineering knowledge? And, you know, I thought it's like the job application materials were written with me in mind is really what it felt like. So I applied, went through the general process, and now I'm here.
That's so cool. That's amazing. So the class that you're teaching is like Comp Linguistics 101, basically?
I'm teaching a couple different classes. Okay. So I taught in the spring, I taught a graduate level intro to computational linguistics. Mm-hmm. And then I teach a class that on paper is called corpus linguistics, which, you know, I think traditionally was meant to be more corpus linguistics for traditional theoretical linguistic research. But the way that I've decided to structure it is to still maintain that that bent, but also to make sure that students are able to work with language data, mm-hmm. right? It's more, for me, I think it's more important that students can create a data set that is representative of whatever question that they are interested in, mm-hmm. be it a theoretical linguistic question, or maybe it's a question about how to get training data for a particular type of model that they're trying to train, right? I want to make sure that, you know, the demographics of this class is very interesting because it is kind of half these computer science and linguistics students, but it's also, there's also a bunch of students that are just pure linguistics majors in it as well. Mm-hmm. So I also want to make sure that those students who aren't in the CS and linguistics program get exposed to things like scripting and mm-hmm. doing basic Python programming, or at least taking away the fear that comes from a lot of people mm-hmm. in terms of starting programming. There is, like, I think, a mental hurdle in a lot of ways, thinking like, oh, I can't do that. But I'm trying to, you know, help them rip off the Band-Aid and get into it in a way that feels accessible and that feels like they're solving a problem that they're interested in, right? Yeah. They're solving a linguistic problem with this data.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. What a great idea to have a corpus linguistics class. I think that is the way a lot of academic linguistic research is going, just because mm-hmm. there are so many linguistic databases now that you can actually get your hands on. Because so much stuff is, you know, in electronic format, as opposed to, you know, 25 years ago when it was all pieces of paper. Mm-hmm. But now it's you know, you can, there's so much publicly accessible stuff in terms of, you know, even if you're looking at, you know, topography databases or whatever, like, mm-hmm. you know, you could just look at data. And if you know how to process it correctly, it's just invaluable. You can look at so much more stuff than you used to, right. and you can get really relevant, statistically significant answers out of stuff rather than having to go around and, you know, collect things by hand, which mm-hmm. you can still do. But this is so much more, it's so powerful when you have these huge corpus databases that you can look through. And if you know how to do it correctly, like if you take a class, it's just incredible. So that's amazing. That's so cool. What other kinds of classes do you plan on teaching in this program? Do you have ideas?
Yeah, so in the fall, I'm going to be teaching an NLP class. So that's a class that is, you know, it's already here and, you know, mm-hmm. part of the curriculum. But I think a lot of times when people take a natural language processing class, they take it from a computer science perspective, mm-hmm. and they don't necessarily take it from the perspective that focuses on the language, the natural language part of it, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, I'm not quite sure exactly how the class is going to go yet, but one of the things that I'm hoping to focus on is, you know, not necessarily just, oh, these are all the algorithms, but why are we doing it in this way? Why does this work and not, and this way not work? Kind of, yeah, foregrounding the language part of it and not necessarily the processing part of it, I guess. Another class that I'm hoping to teach at some point is a class that I actually helped teach at UC Santa Cruz that I want to bring to San Jose State. It's a lower division class, but it would basically be an invented languages class.
Oh, cool.
I think it would be such a good way to, you know, get people interested in linguistics.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
It definitely was at UC Santa Cruz. Like, you know, come to the class. You would talk a lot about, you know, sociolinguistics and world building and culture. And then, you know, creating a language for whatever culture and world that you're building in class, mm-hmm. you know, as a group, as a community. You know, I think it would work really well as kind of a an intro to intro linguistics, but then also, you know, you can bring in some really fun things like, you know, the Avatar movies and Game of Thrones, all with invented languages that are actually created by linguists, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So, and for people listening, see our interview with David Peterson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. That's great. I like it. It's so great when you can pick up on something that gets people into linguistics sort of by a side door, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like here's the fun, cool part of it. And now we're going to sneak some linguistics underneath it. So, you know, right. you're drawing them into it. Oh, that's amazing. That's so cool. So this sounds great. It sounds like you're, you know, you've got some good plans here. I'm sure people ask you this all the time, but would you ever go back into industry, do you think?
I don't think so. No.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, for various reasons, but it's just a lot of, it takes a lot out of you personally, I think. Mm-hmm. I think especially since COVID, since everything went online and mm-hmm. everyone becomes like 24/7 accessible
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really found myself feeling, well, I found myself feeling not like myself because I constantly was feeling like I have to be working. I have to be being productive on something. I have to be showing my worth mm-hmm. in a very specific way. And that's not how I function. That's not how I want to feel. And it could just be the way I'm wired. It could be the way that the particular jobs that I have were structured or that I had were structured. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't think I would want to go back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's totally fair. And it's something that we talked about at the LCL, and I've talked about it a lot on the podcast too, is that each person needs to figure out what kind of work environment is going to be good for them and where you can thrive. And for some people, what you were just talking about, they like that, right? Some people really like a lot of pressure and they like being on and they like that feeling of having to produce. Like that's what makes them produce is the feeling that they have to produce because, yeah. you know, for some people, if that expectation isn't there, they won't do it. And
right.
some people are just like that and that's fine. And then other people, like you said, you know, it's too much. So sometimes you don't know that until you do it. And mm-hmm. then you go, oh, this is great. Or nope, this isn't going to work for me. So everybody just needs to figure out what kind of work environment is actually going to work. And then you can find what kind of place, hopefully, that you can land in where you can do your best work. Because if it's a mismatch, then you're just going to be miserable. And then you should be looking for another job.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I will say, like, I don't regret having worked in the tech industry mm-hmm. at all. Like, I met a lot of really smart people. And, you know, there are people who are still working in their current jobs that I plan on doing research with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, industry academia crossover. So, you know, for me, it was beneficial for a while, but then at some point it was not beneficial anymore. And that's
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's never wasted. You're, right. you're learning stuff. You're always learning stuff and it shapes your journey. And, you know, maybe you would never have ended up where you are now if you hadn't done the things that you did. So
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. This is so cool. Thank you so much for spending this time with me and talking through all this. It's just so interesting. Is it okay if we put your LinkedIn link in the show notes in case people want to contact you for advice or an informational interview, for example?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. It's been so great talking to you too, Laurel. It's been just a pleasure to talk about this today.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. And I'm sure you're going to be hearing from other people. And, you know, I've said this to other people as well, but maybe we'll get to check back in with you in a couple of years and see what you're up to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's do it.
Thanks.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.